So I wanted to continue with some of the Minhagei Purim and understanding more about Purim this way. And then I'll share maybe just the Dvar Torah about Purim in general that I've been thinking about this year. So the I think last time we ended off with the groggers, if I remember correctly, and making noise and things like that. So next thing on my list here is... Costumes. Okay, I'll get to... We did costumes already or not?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I might do more about costumes. I forgot we did costumes. Maybe do more about costumes. And there's other things also here. So... First thing is, I'm not going to go through all the halachas of Purim. There's a lot of halachas, but there is a myth regarding Shalchmanis, which is always worthwhile to mention. Many of us are taught when you're younger that Shalchmanis, you need to have two different foods that are two brachos. That's a myth. You have to have two foods, but the two brachos part's a myth. And the Shulchan Aruch says that it can be two portions of meat. The same thing, both shakal, both meat, those are two portions. So that reaction is a common reaction.
Oh yeah. My God. But I did not have to go. My daughter.
I'm not sure where the brachos thing came from, but there is no source for such a thing in halacha. The idea of it says, mishloch manos, usually send two portions. So a portion just means two portions.
So if you have two different kinds of cakes?
So two kinds of cakes will be fine. Yeah, two kinds of cakes are fine. Okay. There are those who argue even one cake in two pieces would be fine. So I would tell you to do two kinds of cake, but there's an opinion which would say as long as there's two portions of the same food, even would be okay. So I think the minhag seems to be two kinds of foods, but they can be the same bracha. You know, if you want to give two different types of cake, you want to give a piece of chicken and a piece of meat. You want to give a soda and a piece of chicken. They're both shahakol. That's fine. There's no issue there. You want to give, you know, an apple and an orange, that's totally fine. And here you go, it's your mitzvah. So that's one of these myths which is out there. I'm not sure where it came from, but there is no source of such a thing, and certainly you're totally fine. As long as it's two portions of food, you've done your mitzvah. The Iker mitzvah of a Shalchmanis is two portions of food to one person. That's it, you've done your job. The fact we give out to all of our friends, everyone who comes by, is a beautiful thing, creates achdus, but in terms of your obligation, it's just two portions, to one recipient, and you're finished.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So your husband should also give one, and I should give one.
See, that's the best thing to do. Yeah, it's the best thing to do. I mean, technically, many say you are yotzei through your husband. You can do one for the family. But there are others who say it's good to give your own. So I would say each couple, husband with his own, must give his own once, and then you've done your job. Everything else can be shared and split. Uh-huh. And
then I was told also that just leaving it at the door is not the proper way to do it. It should be given personally to the person, because the people I give it to are people I know don't get anything.
Right.
Or very little. And so a lot of times they're not home.
So right. So, okay, so as long as you've given one to a person.
One to a person.
Yeah, then your mitzvah is one. Everything beyond that is bonus.
And
so.
Shliach, is that important to do? Do it through a shliach, or you can do it yourself and just give it to the person?
So a shliach, Mishnah Berurah says that a shliach is ideal. Uh-huh. So, I mean, really the best thing to do would be do one which covers all your chumras and all your bases, and everything else do what you want. So, you know, the one shalchmanis, two portions of food. Send it by means of a shliach to one person who's actually there to receive it, and then you've done your job. And then your yotzei for all of Purim, and anything else you do is just bonus, and you can do shliach, no shliach, two foods, one food, five foods, or home, not home, it doesn't matter, all that's fine.
Because it's a shliach thing, why do you need that?
So, because the pasuk is mishloach manos, sending portions. So there's an opinion which says it means you actually have to send it. So, again, we paskin that if you give it yourself, it's fine, but there is an opinion that you have to send it. So, if you're sending one, it's worthwhile to send one, you know.
Give it to your child.
You give it to a child, say, please deliver this. You can give it to, you know, you know your friend who's at your house is going to your other friend's house next. Can you please deliver this to, you know. Just, as long as you did one, then you've done your job. That's definitely, I think, worthwhile to do, at least for one. Drinks are okay to give also. Some people think that, you know, you can't count a drink or something. Drinks do count. You can give, you know, a can of soda, you can give orange juice, you can give, you know, the drinks do count, that's fine. There is a machlokis. Now, we're familiar with the idea typically that it should be prepared food, already cooked. There is an opinion that says you can even send raw food that could be cooked. I mean, there's levels. I mean, don't send like a live chicken. Oh, they'll shecht it and they'll salt it and they'll skin it. That much probably is not mishloach manos, but to send raw chicken, many hold it's fine to send. Maybe your friend would want a piece of raw chicken at Shalchmanis. It could be, but you know, sometimes it's nice to have food you cook on your own. So it's definitely nice to send cooked foods, but there is an opinion raw foods are also fine. Drinks are totally fine. And the two brachos thing again is a myth. As long as it's two different portions of food, you're in good shape. I just in contrast, it's always good just to contrast to Matanos Lev Yonim, the mitzvah is a gift to two different poor people. So shachmanis is two foods to one person. Matas of Yonim is one gift to two different people who are poor. Say typically if you give to, let's say, an organization, you know, that's enough. They'll distribute it out properly. But when the amount should be given, that's not clear in halacha. It seems to be that the main opinion is it should be enough money that the ani could buy a meal with, which isn't that much. I mean, I would say $4 or $5. You know, you can definitely go to the store, $5, buy some bread, buy some salami. You have a meal. You know, so that's. So I would say if you gave $10 of tesla yonim, which is, you know, 5 and 5, then you're in good shape. That's what I would suggest. There is a concept in halacha, it's better to give more matanos of yonim than a shachmanis. So if you're one of these people who is very elaborate in shachmanis and gives out, you know, dozens and dozens of shachmanis, maybe in your cheshbon give a little bit more money to matanos of yonim to cover those bases as well. That's a nice thing. To think about the poor and to be sure that they are covered, not just your friends are covered, is a beautiful thing. So, you know, it could be some people have, you actually keep track. You know, I spent $72 on my shachmanis, so I'll give 75 matanos of yonim. Yeah, that's, you know, you could do that, but it's recommended to give more to matanos of yonim than to shachmanis. That's recommended. Okay, so that's the idea of shachmanis matanos of yonim. There's a minhag brought down in the Ramah to eat what's called zeronim on Purim. Zeronim means, like, you know, seeds, nuts,
chickpeas.
Right? Chickpeas, yeah, would fall into that category. Chickpeas are also that's the seed. That's the seed of the vegetable. So the idea is because the Ramah says that when Daniel and his group were in the palace in Bavel in Babylonia, they couldn't eat the food, it wasn't kosher, so they gnashed on seeds and nuts and, you know, fruits and the like. So also when Esther was in the palace, what did she eat? Well, she couldn't eat the food either, it wasn't kosher food, so she also would be eating, you know, nuts and berries and seeds and stuff and the like. So there's a minhag on Purim that we should have, at least, you know, one of the things we nash on, I guess, would be seeds and nuts and that type of thing, chickpeas and those types of foods. I guess the lesson you can get from that is to recognize the mysterious nefesh of these people for kashrus in these difficult times. Now you could see Esther at a certain point having to deal with a big challenge. I mean, she's sitting there in the royal palace. They're serving incredible foods constantly. She's invited to all these royal banquets, you know, dealing with dignitaries, you know, and she's smelling it and she's seeing it and she's under pressure. And for her just to keep a diet of seeds and nuts and berries and chickpeas and whatever else is, you know, in that diet, that's her dedication to kashrus. And despite that, she's able to hide the fact that she was Jewish, which is also interesting. You know, despite that she wasn't eating all the food in the palace, they never recognized she was Jewish, and that was, I guess, part of the nes. But because of that, you know, we therefore should eat these foods on Purim. So again, you don't have to sit down to a huge meal of nuts, but there's a minute to have nuts on Purim, or seeds, or berries, not berries, but seeds, or nuts, or chickpeas. Right.
During the Seder, or just...
Whenever, there's a particular time, you know, whenever. Mm-hmm. I think there's some that maybe have it at night, but I don't think it makes a difference. I think,
yeah,
really any time.
Like night, like after the Megillah.
After the Megillah, you come home, you know, breaking the fast, mash on it maybe. But in terms of the Ramah, he didn't say a time. He just says, I'm Purim to have these things. Mm-hmm. Hamantashen. Right, so that's obviously one of our favorite Hagim is Hamantashen. One of our favorites and the most famous. So the classic minhag of Hamantashen was to have it with seeds. Mm-hmm. Now we're familiar with the poppy seed ones. Actually, I saw brought down also sesame seed. Well, I've never seen that in stores, but I saw in a Sefer, he said sesame seeds. I might like them more. I don't like poppy seeds so much because I like that one better. But there's a minhag to have. The Iker minhag, the oldest minhag of Hamantash, was to have it with the seeds inside of it. I didn't see this mentioned, but it could be connects with this other minhag having seeds. That's very possible, such as, you know, the Esther had seeds. But the explanation is given for Hamantashim is that the Yiddish word for the seeds is mun, and it's like haman, right? So it's mun tashin is pockets. So really it's mun tashin, like seed pockets. And then we make it the haman tashin, because that's the remnant of Purim. So that's one explanation given for haman tashin. Haman tashin classically have three corners. I'm not aware of any source that Haman's had at three corners, despite the children's song. Wow. You know, yeah. All the songs talk about the three-cornered hats. I have no source for that one. There's a medrash that talks about the number three in Haman. The medrash says that Haman, when he perceived this chus of the three avos, he became, you know, sort of disheartened. He became weakened. So Haman Tashin, the word Haman Tashin, if you look, you break it up, Haman Tash, Tash in Hebrew is to weaken. Haman weakened. And Medrash says when Haman perceived the three avos, he became weakened, and therefore that's the idea of Haman Tashin, the three different corners of the Haman Tashin and the three avos. So that's the source brought down.
Why did he have a vision of the three avos?
I'm not sure, but I guess someone in that position, you know, he had a lot of different revelations, you know, in terms of what he's about to do and, you know, what he's getting himself involved in. So I guess it comes along with that. It's a good question. Additionally, you know, Purim is a day, besides being the day we celebrate the Nes of Purim, besides being this great day of Simcha, it's another day of Matan Torah. And it's the point of Purim that we hear about occasionally, but we miss. Essentially, the Jews receive the Torah three different times. We receive the Torah on Shavuos. That was the first encounter we had with the Torah. That was, you know, the Seres HaDibros. That was the first Luchos. That was Shavuos. We worship the Egel. We messed up. Luchos are broken. We lost that revelation. And then we did Tshuva. On Yom Kippur of that year, we got the second Luchos. So Shavuos was Matan Torah number one. And Yom Kippur is Matan Torah number two. Now, the Gemara tells us that at that point, the Jews accepted the Torah under duress. By force, which is its own separate discussion, exactly what that means. But on I think one basic level, the Jews were at a point in history that they just experienced incredible miracles. Kriyas Yamsuf, the Makos, Maimon Har Sinai. They couldn't say no. What were they supposed to do? I mean, they saw Hashem clearly. They saw Hashem's power. It was a time of Gilui Panim, where Hashem was totally revealed to the world. And there wasn't really an option. I mean, it was just so clear that Hashem was there, with them, running the world, doing miracles. It was, they're under duress in the sense that they had no, there's no other choices. They didn't have, there's no way out, because what are they supposed to say? They saw everything. It was simple. It was obvious. So that was Matan Torah at Shavuos and Yom Kippur. But the Gemara says, for all these years, the Jews essentially, they had an excuse. They say, Hashem, we didn't choose this. We had no choice in the matter. It was so clear. It was so absolute to take the Torah. Why are you holding us accountable for what we're doing? You know, it's under duress. And we didn't opt into this. We had to do it. So the Gemara says on Purim, the Jews re-accepted the Torah, but willingly. We have the pasuk that says, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim. So that pasuk in its pshat means that the Jews, they essentially affirmed and accepted Purim. But the Gemara tells us, Kimu v'kiblu means the Jews accepted that which they already had accepted before. So meaning that they accepted the Torah once again. But this time it says, not because they're under duress, but mi'avas hanes, because of love, because of their free will. And what they saw was that Hashem, at Purim time, Hashem was hiding. Hashem's hidden in the Megillah. Hashem's name is not anywhere in the Megillah, not mentioned anywhere. It's a nes nister, it's a hidden nes. And the Jews took the Torah on Purim, despite that they couldn't see Hashem clearly, despite that the miracles weren't of the magnitude of Kriyas Yamsuf or the Makos. They said, we see Hashem is with us, He loves us, we want the Torah. Not because we have to, because we want to. And therefore on Purim, that was a new Kabbalah Torah. The Jews re-accepted the Torah on Purim under free will. So the Matan Torah, the number three is actually a significant number. Number one, I just told you there's three Matan Torahs, you know, Shavuos, Yom Kippur, and Purim. But beyond that, the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos, the Gemara says about Matan Torah, it says, Brich Rachmana, Nebarach Hashem, the Yahav Orient Lisai, who gave a three-part Torah to a three-part nation through the third child, the third day of the third month. And what that means is that the Torah has three parts, the Torah Nevim and Ksuvim. It was given through Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the third child, Aaron, Miriam, and Moshe. It was given in Sivan, which is the third month. Mm-hmm. It was given on the third day. They prepared for 3 days for Matan Torah. It says that on the third day, Hashem came down to Har Sinai after 3 days of preparation. It was all threes. Moshe Rabbeinu was from Shevet Levi, who was the third Shevet. So Matan Torah was based on the number three. So therefore, since Purim is Matan Torah, we make a three-cornered Haman Tashin to represent Matan Torah. That's no explanation given. So why is three the number of Matan Torah? We can wait till Shavuos for that one. But that's part of the idea of Haman Tashin. The word we mentioned, Haman Tash, could also break down as Haman got weak, as we said. So besides him getting weak for seeing the Avos, eating the Haman Tash is like we're weakening Haman. We're eating up Haman, making Haman weak. There's a related minhag. This one's less popular. Mati Kreplach Purim. And you can actually see a resemblance between kreplach and hamantashen. You know, it's kreplach also, you have the meat inside of it, and hamantashen have the jelly inside of it, or the poppy seeds, or whatever's inside of it. The idea of eating kreplach, so the concept is brought down, the idea of nes nister, I think you were saying, that the meat inside it is hidden. That you have your outside dough and the meat inside of it. And Purim is the yontif of a nes nister, of the hidden miracle, and therefore on Purim, you eat the kreplach, which has inside of it the hidden meat. So,
is there also a minhag to have two, like, sudas, sort of, or am I mixing this up with something else? Because this kreplach thing is bringing back memories for me.
Erev Yom Kippur, maybe? Erev Yom Kippur is also a minhag of kreplach.
Okay, fine. That's
and there's an idea of having two sudas Erev Yom Kippur.
That I know, but okay, fine. Okay, but nothing with Purim.
To have two sudas?
Like the kreplach thing.
Not that I'm aware of, that I can think of.
Okay.
So there's an idea at Purim night, like after Megillah, to have a nice Suda, and then during the day to have your Purim Suda, but I'm not aware of another Suda in there. But the idea of, so I would suggest also, Hamantashen's also, you have the jelly kind of hidden inside the dough as well, and Hamantashen is the same concept as the Kreplach. I think I mentioned this before, but I mentioned it again, that there's 3 days in the year was Minig brought down to have Kreplach. We always think of Kreplach are these holy things, right? There's a Minig, 3 times a year to have Kreplach. Hoshana Rabbah, Erev Yom Kippur, and Purim, right? And then the way you remember those 3 days is because of 3 days that we clap something, because on Erev Yom Kippur you're clapping Al Chet, Hoshana Rabbah you're clapping your Aravos on the floor, and Purim you're clapping Haman. So you have 3 days you clap something, and the 3 days you have your Kreplach. The reason for Kreplach on Erev Yom Kippur and Hoshana Rabbah is different than for Purim, because those are not days of Nes Nister. That's more of a concept. It's just a side point. The meat's considered representing din, and the dough is rachamim. Mm-hmm. And you want the rachamim to cover up the din. So Yom Kippur and Hoshana Rabbah are days of judgment, so you have the Kreplach to represent. You want Hashem's rachamim to kind of hide or overcome the din, as the meat's considered din. So that's a different reason.
What does the word Kreplach mean?
Kreplo? I mean, kreplo in Yiddish, I think, is just like a wafer or something, isn't it? That's all it comes from. But there's an idea of having a kreplach on Purim. So if you want to add that to your menu for your Purim suit or something, some kreplach, that'd be part of the minhag. But the idea of Purim also, we're always stressing the concept of nes nister, that Hashem is hidden on Purim. We'll talk more about that in a second. But even those foods of Purim represent the Hashem's hidden nature, which came out on Purim. So I forgot last time we said about costumes. I'm going to get the costumes a little bit more this time. I forgot what I mentioned last time. But the costumes on Purim brought down in the Ramah. It's amazing to wear costumes on Purim. I always like to clarify, at the Megillah we should wear Big Day Shabbos. Costumes are good for other parts of the day, but the halacha is that the Megillah you should wear Big Day Shabbos. It's Yantif, you're doing a special mitzvah, so it's right to wear Big Day Shabbos at the Megillah. The costumes are a minig Yisrael, which should you know, it's nice to keep to, but not for the Megillah, it's proper to wear Big Day Shabbos. What are some reasons for costumes? So the one reason I saw, which is sort of, I don't know, a little different than I ever saw before, was that there is a concept on Purim of giving lots of tzedakah. And beyond that, during the year, the lacha is, if you're asked for tzedakah, you're allowed to investigate. Is this person honest? Is this a con artist? You know, that's, you ask them for their little note from the Rav to make sure that they're valid. On Purim, the lacha is called posh yanus nimlo. If you're anyone who stretches out their hand, you give to them. You're not supposed to inform to ask who you are. You don't have to ask for the paper. On Purim, you just give. That's the lacha. So Purim's a day where we're marben tzedakah. So the people who are asking, some people who want to ask for money, they don't want you to know who they are, because they know in Purim they can get. It could be during the year they're too ashamed to ask. You look into them, you'll figure out who they are. On Purim, you don't have to figure out who I am. So I can ask you for money, you have to give me money. But I don't want you to know who I am, because I'm ashamed. So people put on costumes so they'd ask for money and not be embarrassed for asking. During the rest of the year, if you ask for money, then people will have the right to figure out your identity, because they're allowed to look into you and figure out who you are. On Purim, you can avoid that, so the costume helps you to remain anonymous in collecting tzedakah. Well, that's one interesting reason I saw. That obviously doesn't apply to everybody, doesn't apply to the kids, doesn't apply to people who, Baruch Hashem, have means, no need to ask for money. But that is one explanation given for the idea of costumes on Purim. Other explanations given. The Megillah itself stresses often clothing. We know that Mordechai came out b'levush malchus. We talked about he came out in royal garments, and we put on our different garments to sort of indicate Mordechai's change of clothing. The Mordechai began, normal. He put on sack v'efer, he put on sackcloth to mourn, and they put on the royal garments when he became in Haman's place. So costumes sort of also are shini begadim. We're changing our clothing to represent Mordechai's change of clothing. The Gemara says in Maseches Megillah that one of the reasons for the Gezerah of Purim, why were we liable for destruction? So the Gemara says we have two reasons. One was that the Jews benefited from Achashverosh's party. And the second reason given, which is a broader reason, is that in the times of Nebuchadnezzar, who was really the previous empire prior to Achashverosh, and the Jews bowed down to Avodah Zarah. So the Gemara says that Hashem says about us, just like our bowing down to Avodah Zarah was only lepanim, it was only on the surface. In our hearts, we believed in Hashem. We were Jews, we were devoted. On the surface level, we bowed down to Avodah Zarah. So too Hashem says the decree against us on Purim was only on the surface level. Deep down in Shemayim, we weren't going to be destroyed. But there was Haman put on a show. Hashem let Haman put on a show that looked like we were going to be destroyed. So just like the Jews, when they bowed to Avodah Zarah, were doing it only on the surface, but deep down they were still Jews. So too the threat against us only on the surface, but deep down in Hashem's hashkacha, it was never going to happen. That's the Gemara says. So for that reason, we put on costumes, because we're showing that everything is just on the surface level. The word is lepanim, on the face. So costumes are also showing it's a superficial thing. It's not who I am, this is just the outside. So the Jews, when they bow down to Avodah Zarah, they're saying, we aren't really of the Avodah Zarah, that's just the outside you see, inside we're Jews. And when Hashem let Haman make the Gezerah, Haman also was only on the outside, but deep down we were safe. So he put on costumes to represent this whole concept of Purim that we are, it was all just a surface level Gezerah, based on a surface level chait, and deep down it wasn't real. Deep down we were really Jews, we didn't believe in Avodah Zarah. Deep down Haman's plan was never going to happen, and therefore the costume says this is who I am on the outside, but deep down that's not me. That's another concept given. What I feel is the main reason for the costumes is the concept again of Nes Nister, of the hidden miracle. A hidden miracle means that on the outside you don't see a miracle. You don't see Hashem. And really this is based on the Gemara says, Esther Metorah Minayin. Where do you find a reference to Esther in the Chumash itself? We know the story of Esther happened 2,000 years or something after the Chumash occurred. But the Chumash contains everything. So the Gemara says, where do you find a reference to Esther in the Chumash? So Gemara says, it's the pasuk Anochi Haster Aster Panai. Hashem says, I will hide my face. So the whole story of Purim, the word Esther and Aster are connected, hidden. But the story of Purim is about Hashem being hidden behind the scenes. And literally, Hester Panim, Hashem's face is hidden. So just, the word Hester Panim means my face is hidden, so a mask hides my face. And we act with Hester Panim in order to show that the miracle of Purim was a miracle of Hester Panim. The Gemara says on this pasuk, Anochi Haster Astir, there's a double language there. Haster Astir, I will. The article always says, I will surely hide my face. That's always the article translation. We have double languages. But it stresses the hiding twice. So the Gemara says, it's a Hester besoch Hester. It's hidden within the hidden. Which means, sometimes somebody's hiding, and they're hiding. Sometimes somebody's hiding, and you can't even tell they're hiding. So the story of Purim was that Hashem wasn't just hiding. Hashem was hiding in a way that we couldn't even tell he was around at all. That's how much Hester there was. And despite that, Hashem still came out and did the miracle. There's a song that got popular in recent years. I think it's a quote from Nachum of Breslov. I think if I remember correctly. But the song goes, Afilu b'hastara b'soch hastara. Even if it's hidden within the hidden, Bevadai gam sham nimsa Hashem Yisbarach. Certainly there you find Hashem. So even when things are hidden and hidden and hidden, layers and layers and layers, Hashem is still there deep down. And Hashem's always there. And then it says, the rest of the quote is, gam echori advarim hakashim. Even after the most difficult things, and ani omei, that's where I'm standing. behind all the walls, behind all the troubles, behind all the distress, behind all the tragedy, you still find Hashem there. So as hidden as Hashem seems to be, Hashem is always there. So the firm story is that Hashem seemed totally gone. He's not mentioned anywhere in the Megillah. Hashem's name is not anywhere in the Megillah. The Jews really felt they're going to be destroyed. No, they were on the line. That was it. And it was finished. And then still the miracles just pop out. And Hashem still, you don't even see Hashem there, but Hashem's still doing the miracles behind the scenes. So putting on the costume is a way that we recognize the idea of a nes nister, hester panim. Hashem is hiding, but he's still there. No, the costume, there's a costume here, but I'm still behind the costume. It's still me, even though you see something on the surface. The lesson of Purim is that what's real is not always what we see at the surface level. One of the major lessons of Purim is what you see is not what you get. Haman, you think he has so much power? Well, he's dead. You think this gezeira is so scary? Well, it never occurred, and the opposite occurred. The lesson of Purim is that I'm not really what we see in front of your face is not really what's happening. Hashem functions behind the scenes, and what we see in the world is not exactly the reality. The reality is the way that Hashem pulls the strings from behind the curtain. That's the Purim story. So the idea of wearing the costume is that what you see is not what you get. You see a bear, but it's not a bear, it's me. But you see a bear in front of you. Because Hashem says, you see Haman, it's not really Haman, it's also me. And you see a threat, it's not really a threat, it's also me. You see a potential tragedy, it's not. That's me just trying to get you to tshuva. What's happening behind the scenes is the reality. What's happening in the surface is not the reality. So the costume tells you, I'm not what you actually see. There's something more. It's important for us to always recognize that we are all like that. Because we are not what you see. The reality of ourselves is that Hashem inside. The body is just the expression through which the Neshama expresses itself to the world. So we think that we stop right here at surface level. It's not true. There's a much deeper part of ourselves. And when you put on a costume, you're showing that even my body is not really me. But what's really me is much deeper inside that you can't see. That's what a costume shows. So I do think, I now remember last time I spoke about the masvah. I spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu's mask, I think, last time. Is that right? I think that's what we spoke last time.
So red from
Yeah, right. So that's what we got to last time. I guess we can skip that part for now. But those are all different reasons for the costume. And just, I guess to go back to Moshe Rabbeinu, the one time you find a mask in the Torah is Moshe Rabbeinu's mask. And it's interesting because when you find something in the Chumash, the first place you find it usually is the root of the concept. The famous idea of Rav Sarka Cohen, he says that the first time you find any concept in the Torah, that sort of defines, that's the shorish, that's the roots of that concept. So if you want to know what's the first source we have for the idea of wearing a mask, it's Moshe Rabbeinu's mask. So Moshe wasn't hiding from anybody. Moshe wasn't disguising himself. Moshe was holding back the spiritual radiance which he had. That's what he was doing. So for us, it's also to recognize that we have also a spiritual radiance. And that's often held back, by our bodies. We have to know it's all a mask, because inside of us is that same spiritual radiance, Moshe Rabbeinu was zocha to actually shine forth, and we have in ourselves. And it's just always covered up by that mask. So in Purim, it's a time also to recognize that. Then you put on your extra mask, you realize that even my body's just a mask, because inside of me is something which is powerful, it's shining forth, it's spiritual, and it's radiant. So that's the idea of the mask. I want to get now maybe to talk about the idea of drinking for a second on Purim. This is one of these halachas which is controversial, I guess, in some ways, misunderstood in some ways, misused in some ways, corrupted in some ways, beautiful in some ways. I mean, it really depends on your experiences and who you're around and how people use it. But I have to go through very quickly. It's a Gemara. The Gemara says, Chai v'nishlam sumi puriya, a person is obligated to drink on Purim, Ad lo yada, until you no longer know the difference between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. That's the words of the Gemara. The Gemara continues, though, and the Gemara says that, the very next story in the Gemara is that one time Rabbah invited Rabbi Zeira to his house for Purim, and basically it sounds like things got so out of hand. It says, come Rabbah. Rabbah got up, and he shechted Rabbi Zeira, and he killed him. So Baruch Hashem, Rabbah was a great Talmud Chacham and Tzaddik, and he knew how to be Mechayah HaMesim. So he davened and brought him back to life. The next year, he invited him back for the night for the Suda. And Rav Zera said, well, you know, last year didn't turn out so well. I can't rely upon a nace every single year, so this year I think I'll stay home. that was his response. So commentaries point out, like, you know, what are we learning from that story? So some commentaries say that the point of that story is to show that this halacha is not true. That when you drink that much, it's dangerous and it's not a good idea. Because look, Rav Zera got killed because of it. Some commentaries say, well, the next year, the fact he refused showed that they were planning to drink again. So, like, had they been sober, he would have gone back to Rabbah's house. But, you know, because they're probably planning to drink some more, he said, I'm going to stay away from you this year. But two ways to learn that Gemara. But the Shulchan Aruch does say this idea, a chayav nesh masume, a person has to drink on Purim. And the question halachically is, you know, what kind of obligation is that? To what extent? What does it mean? Ultimately, the Mishnah Berura says, if anyone's going to drink to the point where they're going to ignore any halacha, they can't do it. So if it means not benching properly, and not davening properly, insulting somebody, saying Lashon Hara, then you shouldn't drink anything. The Rambam says it just means to drink more than you're accustomed to and then fall asleep. And that covers the halacha.
Who says that?
The Rambam. The Rambam. And essentially, the idea, you know, the idea is to, you know, it's appropriate to have some wine in the Purim Suda, but you have to know yourself and stay within control. That's how the halacha is sort of quoted. I think it's more important to understand the concept. I mean, the halacha itself, it has its applications, but to understand the concept, like, it's a wild thing that Chazal would say this, that a person should drink to such an extent. And the way that they word it, so you don't know between Haman and Mordechai, I mean, that would require a lot of alcohol to really not know Haman versus Mordechai. It's a wild thing. So there are those who say it means until you can no longer compute the gematria of our Haman Baruch Mordechai. So that might be a little bit less wine. But in general, it's a fascinating idea. And furthermore, the wording ad lo yada, until you no longer know the difference. We Jews usually pride ourselves on our das, that our minds should be sharp, we should understand things, we should focus our minds. And to say that we have a mitzvah or a halacha that you should dull your mind is a wild thing. We know that a nazir is considered kadosh, he refrains from wine. So what's this concept that Chazal would tell you? You should drink wine and you should numb your das to the point where you're confused between good and bad. The whole thing doesn't really make sense. The simple meaning of where it comes from is just that the miracles of Purim occurred all within the context of a Mishta Yayin, of a wine party. That's how the story began when Vashti was killed. That's the story when Esther had her party and had Haman killed. So the miracles of Purim, the context of the miracles was during a wine party. So we understand the emphasis of having some wine on Purim. That part we get. But again, but just the extent of how much, that's a wild thing. So I'll share with you just two thoughts on this in terms of the concept. One more simple, one a little bit deeper. You know, one concept just is goes back to the idea of Nes Nisr from before, the idea of a hidden miracle. You know, really inside of ourselves is a lot that we keep hidden all the time. People have inhibitions. People are embarrassed of certain things about themselves. People are shy. People hold back. When someone drinks a little bit of alcohol, they become looser. And often the real person comes out, hopefully for good, but the real person comes out. When Purim is the day where we're trying to focus on not on the surface, but understanding the reality behind the scenes. And with the idea of alcohol bringing out the person to be a little bit more open about themselves, that fits very much the theme of Purim, because those inhibitions fall, and the externals kind of fall away, and the person ends up, you know, expressing themselves in a more honest way, in the right context. So that's one concept. Again, I'm not talking about the application, I'm talking about the concept. That's one concept of drinking. A much deeper concept, which I don't want to go too much in depth right now. But if we think about those words, Ad lo yada ben Arham Baruch Mordechai, until you no longer know between Haman and Mordechai. So they're very reminiscent of another term that we're familiar with. We know in Gan Eden there was the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. You know, we spoke about that in depth last year. So the chait of Adam and Chava was not to eat from the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. So it's the same words. It's a tree that gave you knowledge of good and evil. On Purim it says, Ad lo yada, till you no longer have knowledge of Haman and Mordechai, of good and evil. Right? So it's sort of the flip side of what occurred in Gan Eden. In Gan Eden there was a mitzvah, stay away from that tree, and they were chote and ate from the tree which gave them das of good and evil. On Purim, the Gemara is saying that person should reach a state where they no longer have das of good and evil. So many Sfarim point out this connection. And I guess just to talk about it in short, there is we in life as we are right now, we have a perception which is for us, I guess, a reality, but essentially flawed, which is that we look at the world and we see some events we look at as tragic, terrible, rishus, ra, and we see some events look great and beneficial and pleasant and kind. And the bad events we see, so there's often a notion that, Hashem wasn't there. Where was Hashem? Lama zavtanu. Why aren't you there with us? Why did you let that happen? And the good events, we say, Baruch Hashem, thank you so much, Hashem, for letting this happen. So on the surface level, we see it that way because, one event is bad, so seemingly Hashem, left us alone and let it happen, and one event is good, that Hashem guided it. But on a much deeper level, that's wrong, because everything's Hashem. When a tragedy happens, that's Hashem guiding us to that for a reason. And when good things happen, it's also Hashem. The Tov and the Ra are all Hashem. Essentially, it's all the same thing. It's just the way we perceive it is wrong. So you look at Haman, you say, Haman's really bad. You look at Mordechai's really good. Right? But then after you read the Megillah, you look back and say, yeah, Haman was bad, but wait a minute. Look at what Haman did for us. Haman gave us a tremendous Yantif, a day of Simcha. He gave us four mitzvos. Shachmanes, Hasyonim, Suda, Megillah. Haman led to the building of the second base of Mikdash because it was Esther's son who built it. And without Haman, the Jews wouldn't have had done tshuva. The Jews did a national tshuva. The Jews killed their enemies out. I mean, Haman was one of the greatest things that ever happened to Klal Yisrael. He was amazing. Haman was great. So on one level, you say Haman's a Rasha, he's burning in Gehenna, he's a terrible person, he's a malach to kill him. Another level, you say Haman was incredible. Haman was the greatest gift that Klal Yisrael ever received. Because look where he brought us. So is Haman good or bad? The answer is, well, it depends how you look at it. We, after reading the Megillah, we're going to say Haman was great. He wasn't a great person, but he was great for us. So you say, who was better, Mordechai and Haman? Well, Mordechai was the greater tzaddik, but who was better for Klal Yisrael? I mean, that's a toss-up at this point. Mordechai that Haman wouldn't have been able to do what he did either, because Mordechai needed the Haman to lead Klal Yisrael to that tshuva. And if Haman didn't make these gezeros, Mordechai would have just been a tzaddik sitting there, Bashar HaMelech, learning and teaching, but he wouldn't have had the influence he had on us through the Megillah, because if Haman never rose to power, Mordechai would have just remained a great tzaddik, and that would have been it. But because of Haman's rise to power, now Mordechai has influenced history, and has become one of the most inspirational figures in the Torah for the rest of history after that. So it's a different perspective. Is Haman Ra, is Haman Tov? Depends how you look at it. The Eitz HaDaas Tov HaRa, after that Chet, literally, it's a tree that gave us a knowledge of good and evil. People started saying, once Adam and Chav ate from the tree, there was now this false perspective in life that, oh, there's bad things and there's good things. There's things that Hashem, let's say, is not... Is the things that are lacking, Hashem's not involved in, and there's things Hashem is involved in, and that's how we see things sometimes. That's called das tov ra. We have to discern, what's good, what's evil, and that's the reality of our lives. That's how we live. But from a much higher perspective, it's not true. Now, before they made das tov ra, they're able to see that everything is good. Everything's from Hashem. And it says in Bereishis, it says, Hashem is everything He made. And He said it's tov ma'od. It's very good. And the Medrash says tov ma'od. That's the Yitzhar Hara. That's tov ma'od. It says Yitzhar Tov is tov. Tov ma'od Yitzhar Hara. So we ask ourselves: is Yitzhar Hara tov ma'od? We say no. It's terrible. It's horrible. It's a struggle. It makes me do things I don't want to do, and it tempts me. And the answer is yeah. But that's really good because that's how you grow. That's what makes you into who you are. That's what pushes you to become a better person. That helps you be able to fight battles. That motivates you, gives you ambition. That's Yitzhar Hara. So he's Tov Ma'od. So that's the perspective. Yitzhar Das Tov Ra is the corrupt perspective. It's the false perspective. You go before that into Gan Eden, and there, Adam and Chava, everything was good. They understood everything is Hashem, and everything is good. So Adavu Yodav and Aram Baruch Mordechai, the idea of this, again, not the practical application, but the concept that the Gemara is trying to give across to us, is that Purim is a day that through the miracles of the Megillah, you recognize the world, how it was prior to the Chelei Tzedas Tavara. You bring yourself back in Ad Delo Yada, before they had Das. Before they had to discern between good and evil, they saw it was all good. In the Megillah, you're able to actually see that everything is good. That's what you can see. I always find it amazing. Ar Haman and Baruch Mordechai are the same as Zekamatria. Exactly, 502. Well, they're both 502. And it, because it totally fits the concept, which is that Haman and Mordechai, from one perspective, they're the same. You know, they're both messengers of Hashem to improve Klal Yisrael. Mordechai in his way, Haman in his way. On a lower perspective, you know, Haman's a Rasha, and Mordechai's a Tzaddik, and Haman's burning Gehenna, and Mordechai is sitting in the highest heights of Gan Eden. But on a higher perspective, in terms of Hashem's Hashkacha, in terms of history, they're both doing the same thing for us. They're both here to guide us towards Hashem and towards Tshuva, and to become better people. So there's a very deep remez in this concept of drinking, of Ad Delo Yada, because it's transplanting us to a point, it's showing us there's a perspective of Purim that actually fits the world prior to the Chayil of Eitz Hadas Tovara. So there's more to say about that. It's a very deep point, but it's in exactly in those words. The words of the Gemara are exactly pointing to that concept. So again, practically, what should people do? That's a different discussion. How literally do you take it's a different discussion. But the concept the Gemara is expressing is a very deep concept. So that's the idea of drinking on Purim. There actually is discussion.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
Just talking about men, right?
Yeah, talking about men. Right, talking about men. Again, the concept we're talking about is everybody's perspectives, but the practical drinking parts for men. Yeah, correct. It's even actually discussed, you know, is it only wine to drink, or can you drink other things also? But again, that based on the idea that it's the Mishta Hayayin, that the miracles happen around wine would be the beverage of choice for Purim. So that's the idea of drinking. So just one more thought about when it's here about Purim, is that this is nothing with Menhagim, a separate thought. But there's a beautiful idea from Yaakov Kamenetsky in his Perish on Tanakh. He speaks about it. He has a parish on Al Tanakh, and he speaks about it in Megillas Esther. He says his point, which it's a beautiful point. At first, it's hard to see how it relates to Purim, but I'll tell you how it very much relates to Purim. It says in the Megillah, "The Esther noses chaim eni koroeha." The Esther found grace in the eyes of all that saw her. So no one knew she was Jewish, and the Gemara says that every nation was trying to claim Esther as theirs. Because, you know, they fail. If the queen is from us, we get benefits, you know. He'll reward us, he'll give us special privileges because the queen came from our nation. So every nation came in. You know, Ahasuerus was the world emperor. He really ruled over most of the ancient world. And every single province came and said, no, she's ours. They all claimed her. So Rav Yaakov says, you know, realistically, how is that even possible? Meaning, for instance, I don't mean to stereotype, but if you were to take someone who grew up in Zimbabwe and take someone who grew up in Canada, you're going to see differences. It's very hard to claim that this Zimbabwean is Canadian or vice versa. Take someone who grew up in China and someone who grew up in Guatemala, you're going to find differences. It's just, you know, that's just the reality of life. So Esther must have appeared in some way, you know, not like every nation. Like, you know, like some nations maybe she could fit, but how could every nation claim her as theirs? What did they see in her to say, she's one of ours? How could that be? So Rav Yaakov says that this is really a ticket to understanding how Mashiach is going to work. A beautiful idea, he says. You know, Mashiach is going to come, and Mashiach is supposed to unite Klal Yisrael as one. Well, we have a problem. Let's say the Mashiach is Hasidish, right? So what are Litvish going to say? They say, we can't accept him, you know, he davens later than we do, and he doesn't learn enough, and he goes to the mikvah too often, and, you know, his pace are so long, and ours are short, and, you know... Let's say that the Mashiach is Sephardi. What is Ashkenazim going to say? You know, and let's say the Mashiach is a Yeki. So what are the Nayakis going to say? Let's say the Mashiach is Sioni. What is Satmar going to say? Let's say he's Lubavitch. We know, like, he's got to be somebody. How is everyone going to accept him? So Rav Yaakov says it's such a beautiful idea. He said, you know, Klal Yisrael, we have 12 Shvatim. And every Shevet has their milos, their virtues, their way to serve Hashem. So you also have to see the positive. It says the Gemara says, there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, it says, what's the name of Mashiach? What's Mashiach's name? So the Gemara is very funny. The Gemara says that Rav Shila's yeshiva said that Mashiach's name is Sheila. And then Rav Chizkiya's yeshiva said his name is Chizkiya. You get the point. Rav Yana's yeshiva said his name is Yinon, like Yanai. So every yeshiva said that Mashiach's name was like their Rebbe's name. So what does it mean? So Yaakov says what it means is that Mashiach's going to encompass the great virtues of every part of Klal Yisrael. So everyone will look at Mashiach and they'll see that he's ours because he has our virtue. So the Hasidim will look at the Mashiach and they'll say, oh, Mashiach, you know, he davens with the passion of a chassid. And Livish will say, he learns with the fire of a litvak. And the Sephardi will say, you know, he gives kavod to the chacham like a Sephardi. And the Tzioni will say, he settles Eretz Yisrael like a Tzioni. And the Yeki will say, he's as organized and punctual as a Yeki. Everyone's going to see in Mashiach, you know, their mile, because Mashiach will encompass it all. And it's so something with Esther. You know, Esther contains so many different milos. Every nation could say, you know, look at that trait she has. That trait belongs to us. You could see clearly, because look, she has those traits. You know, these Talmidim and those yeshivas, they said Mashiach's name is like our Rebbe, because the Mashiach encompassed the traits of our Rebbe. And so Mashiach's going to mean that he could be any part of Klal Yisrael, but he's going to encompass every part of Klal Yisrael has their milo, has their virtue. And Mashiach will encompass all those virtues. That's what Rav Yaakov says. So I think that's a very important Purim message, because this really is one of the keys to Avas Yisrael and to Achdus. The Purim's a day that we're supposed to create Achdus. It's clear in the Megillah, Lichnos Kol Yehudim, everyone came together as one in the Megillah. That's part of the way we fought Haman, was through unity. Shach Manas Vatas of Yonah, Mitzvahs of Unity. It brings together Purim. And the Simcha of Purim, it's natural. Everyone feels very close, friendly on Purim. It's a day that brings together Achdus of Klal Yisrael. Well, how do you do that? You have to be able to see the virtues in every single Jew. Every Jew has their virtues. Every Jew has their shortcomings. And the Achdus, the idea of Avas Yisrael, is to be able to not look at somebody's shortcomings, but to look at their virtues and say, I love and appreciate that person based on his or her virtues that he or she contains. And that's one of the big messages of Purim. Haman comes into Achashverosh. He says, Yeshno am mefuzar am mefor ben am. There's a nation out there which is scattered and separate. So Haman's taina is that Klal Yisrael is not united. And so we have to unite to fight Haman. And we unite. Lichnos kol Yehudim. Esther says, gather together everybody. Let them unite. Let them be one. And through that, we can fight against Haman. So Purim today, we're really working towards real Achdus. And being that Purim is a day where we celebrate Geula, and hoping for the final Geula will only occur when Klal Yisrael comes together as one. You know, as long as we still have Sinas Chinam and we're torn apart, so then we're not going to reach the final Geula. But if Klal Yisrael can join together and appreciate each other, that brings us to the final Geula. So it's a very, very powerful message of Purim. I'll just tell you one quick story from when I was in Eretz Yisrael. So the I got to go to the Coastal twice, Baruch Hashem. That's one of my special treats of going, even though I was working most of the time. But I did get a little time to myself. So I was there on Rosh Chodesh Adar at night. And it was the first night of Rosh Chodesh. And now sometimes it's nice to just to watch, see what's happening around there. It's such like a beautiful area just to watch, to see everybody come in, what they're doing. So there was a minyan that finished Mariv on one side of the Coastal. And after the minyan, you know, they started dancing, Mishnah Sanavar B'Simcha. So it started off as a small minyan, I guess 10 to 15 people. And then, but people started joining one by one. And as they start dancing at the Coastal, so everyone starts joining in. And you start seeing Jews of all walks of life. Again, you have the Chassid, you have the Litvak, and the Tzioni, and the Chiloni. Everyone's coming together. The Sephardi, Ashkenazi, probably some of the Chinese tourists also. Like, so everybody joins in over there. But suddenly there's this big circle of all kinds of Jews all dancing together. And you rarely see that in Jewish life. I think the one place that brings them together, the Coastal is a place where you always feel that Achdus, you know. And I find it so emotional. You know, when you go to the Coastal, you know, you should be crying, I guess, over the Churban Abayis. But sometimes we don't feel that. But when you see the beauty and the Achdus of Klal Yisrael coming together, it's such a beautiful sight. You know, that can also bring a tear to the eye. And you know, you look at that type of sight, and you see, look, these are Jews, all different walks of life, from different countries. They serve Hashem, you know, in their own ways. Everyone, Chassid and Litvak, Mesfarshkin, do different things in some ways. But to come together as one with that achdus is so beautiful, and that's what times Mashiach will look like. You know, they'll look, Klal Yisrael, we're not all going to change to be one type of Jew. Everyone's still going to be serving Hashem in their own way, but united and focused, you know, on our goals, which is serving Hashem Baruch Hu properly. So I had experienced that when I went to the coastal on Rosh Chodesh. It's such a beautiful sight, and it's like, but it reminded me very much of this idea of Yaakov, that you know, you see the virtues of every single Jew and how they come together as one. I'm sorry, Phil Kamperum.